Aloha, and welcome to Season 2 of the Hawaii Business Podcast, presented by Servco Pacific. In each episode, we take you behind the scenes with Hawaii's most influential business, community, and cultural leaders. Our guests share their unique career paths and reveal their plans for the future, and you'll hear career, business, and leadership advice that's ideally suited to Hawaii. Let's get started. It's Season 2 of the Hawaii Business Podcast. Here's your host, Anyang Nakata.
Today's episode is presented by Servco Pacific. Helping create life moments that matter to you is their secret to being recognized as one of Hawaii's best places to work for over 19 years. Join the team that's dedicated to service by visiting servco.com/careers. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Hawaii Business Podcast. We're in Season 2, and today I'm so jazzed to have with me Peter Ingram, President and CEO of Hawaiian Airlines and the parent company, Hawaiian Holdings, Inc. Welcome, Peter.
It's good to be here.
Say that again with your FM voice that you told me about.
The FM radio voice that is deeper.
Okay. So, much like the editor of the Hawaii Business Magazine, you are from Canada. You grew up in the suburbs of Toronto, and I Googled what Toronto is known for, which is actually quite a bit. But these are the things that stood out. It's considered the financial and industrial capital of Canada. Toronto has a high concentration of banks and brokerage firms on Bay Street in the financial district, which will come into play later because of your father and also you. And it's very diverse. It's nearly 50% Asian whenever that article came out. So, you know, I know you grew up in the suburbs, but that entire area is very diverse, right?
Yeah, Toronto's a very international city. It's really a great cosmopolitan city. It's a long way from here, and so people don't know about it as much.
Right.
They think about
but
Canada,
there's a lot of commonalities.
They think about Vancouver, but Toronto is a great city. It really
yes.
is.
Yes. And there's a Toronto International Film Festival, and there was lots of other things. And then here's one I saw. It says locals call it Toronto.
Yeah, no that T becomes silent. It's sort of the slang.
Yeah.
It is Toronto, but it's become Toronto to those of us who.
So if I visit and
there.
I say, "Oh, I'm so happy to be here in Toronto," they'll be like, "Visitor."
They'll have you marked.
Okay. So, when we had met to talk story, you shared with me a little bit about your parents and how, you know, your father was one of 8 and your mother was one of 11. And they both grew up independently on farms, you know, very rural, working on the family business. But they were both unique. And tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think, you know, growing up on farms really taught them a work ethic. And both my parents were from big families. They didn't come from significant means. My mother's parents actually were the first generation to emigrate from Austria, in fact, into Canada.
Okay.
And so
you have a Germanic background.
Eastern European. Mm-hmm. It's actually, they were of Ukrainian descent, which I've thought about more over the past year.
Yeah.
My parents were of their families, they were the two that left where the, you know, most of their siblings still lived around where their parents grew up, got into farming. My parents were the ones who left for the city. So they were the ones who ventured away. And similar, you know, years later, that became my wife and I were the ones in our families to move far away from home and build a life somewhere else.
Yeah, yeah. And you're, you know, neither of your parents had the opportunity to go to college. And I heard from you that so it was very important to them that their 3 kids attain that opportunity, right?
Yeah, that was something that they really were very serious about, is that they, I think, missed that opportunity to get a higher education. They didn't have the luxury. They had to go and start working and earning their keep, supporting their families. And so when my brother and sister and I were growing up, the most important thing in their mind for us to do was to get an education, to go to college, and to you know, build a life based around the education that that they were so proud to have been able to provide for us.
Yeah. You know, your father, through sheer grit and innate intellect, did actually become CFO of a coffee company.
He was.
And yeah. I believe it affected you or inspired you quite a bit. And so you attended the University of Western Ontario, which is near your home. And when I brought this up to Steve Petranek, the editor of Hawaii Business, he goes, oh, that's a great school.
It is a great school. Yeah.
It's known for this, and this. And it's Canada's leading business school and all those things. And I was like, okay. So you majored in finance.
Yeah. My father was, as you said, a CFO of a coffee company. And when I realized that I didn't have the underlying ability to be a professional athlete, I thought about what I might do for a living besides that.
What sport did you play in high school?
I played football in high school.
Not basketball?
No, football was my passion at that point. It was before I went to Duke. Then if I had fallen in love with Duke before then, I probably would have been more into basketball as a kid.
Did you play football your entire high school career?
I did, yeah. And football was my father's favorite sport, so that was the one that he steered us into as we were kids.
Yeah, that's neat. So you're at the University of Western Ontario, and you graduate, and then you tell me that you worked for a few years in an investment research firm at a brokerage firm in Toronto, and then something inspired you to change careers because you realized you just didn't have the passion for it that you felt that you should. So tell me about that.
Yeah, so when I went to school for my undergraduate business degree, and I was attracted to Western because that was the leading business school in the country, I thought about what I wanted to do, and the business that was popular at the time was financial services. And so I decided to, you know, apply for jobs on Bay Street, which you mentioned earlier. Bay Street is the Canadian version of Wall Street. And I went to work for a brokerage company doing investment research. And I realized that it was fine, but it wasn't really inspiring me what the work I was doing. And actually, there were a couple of events. One was meeting with an executive from a company called Torstar, which was the parent company of the Toronto Star newspaper, also the parent company of Harlequin Romances.
Oh, that makes total sense.
And I was interviewing the CFO of the company to do research. And I realized, you know, what he was doing was way more interesting to me than what I was doing. You know, sitting down, making decisions, shaping the future of a business. And I thought that was what I wanted to do and not be in financial services. Not that there's anything wrong with
financial services.
It's great business, but it wasn't my passion.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought about it and decided I would pursue an MBA and use that as a springboard to changing my career direction. I wasn't sure exactly what I wanted to do, but I knew that financial services wasn't what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And that was when I applied to business school, and I went to Duke University.
Okay. So, you know, before we get to Duke, because there's a lot there, it was super fun listening to you about your time at Duke. And I shared with you right before we put our headsets on is that I looked at some YouTube videos last night of the Duke basketball game against Michigan. When you were telling me about the conversation and what it sparked in you, it reminded me of when Mark Fukunaga shared that there was this one day, all day deliberations or negotiations, and then he was asked, hey Mark, okay, you can turn everything around by 8 a.m. tomorrow morning, we're gonna go out to dinner, right? And he was like, it wasn't about the whiskey, we were joking, it wasn't about the whiskey and the ribeye, but he realized, okay, nothing wrong with this, the work that I'm doing, but that, what they're doing, relationships, negotiating, creativity, that's what I want to be doing. And so it's really neat that you kind of had a similar moment.
Yeah, I think you have to, if you want to really be as successful as you can be, whatever your capabilities are, you want to be passionate about it.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to be excited about it. And, you know, if work feels like work, then it's really not, you're not going to be the best you can be. If work is something you really enjoy doing and you enjoy the people you're with, and even when it's hard, it's it's inspiring. It's fun. And that's what I've been able to, you know, find since I changed directions of my career and moved into the airline industry.
Well, it's like you called yourself as soon as we sat down when I came to visit. You said, I'm an airline guy.
I am an airline.
And I said, oh, okay, let's talk about that.
It's been almost,
through and through.
Almost 30 years.
Through and through. And look, you're
life.
Smiling. There's, you know, you don't know this, right? Because you're not looking at yourself, but there are certain moments that you smile. When you say airline guy, you smile. When we talk about Duke, you smile. When we talk about basketball, you smile. So, okay, so let's talk about Duke. Why did you choose Duke and the Fuqua School of Business to get your MBA? Lots of options.
Yeah, I wanted to go to a U.S. school. I already felt like I had been to the best business school in Canada, and I thought it would give me an opportunity to pursue a career with companies in the United States. And to me, the United States, while I love Canada and I'm still passionate about it, when Winter Olympics rolls around, I'm red and white.
What's your favorite Winter Olympic sport to watch? Because mine is curling.
It is curling and hockey.
The two gently, the polar opposites.
The four medals that I care about Canada winning at the Winter Olympics.
Curling?
Men's and women's curling, men's and women's hockey.
Oh, men's and women's curling.
We go 4 for 4 in those. I don't care about any of the other sports.
Okay, that's hilarious. Okay, so getting back to Duke. So, you know, a lot of choices,
yeah.
Right? You could have gone right near to Booth at Chicago, right? So why Duke? I understand the U.S. and all that stuff, but why Duke?
Part of what I wanted, I'm a huge sports fan. I was always a sports fan growing up and played sports as I was a kid. And one of the things that I felt like was missing in my life, having gone to undergraduate in Canada, was you don't have the same passion around college sports. So I was looking for a place that was a great business school, because I wanted the good education.
Of course.
But I also wanted some of that U.S. college experience that I didn't have. So I looked at places that had either a great football program or a great basketball program, so I could get that. And Duke is by far the best. Cameron Indoor Stadium is the best place in the world to watch a sporting event.
Yeah. Well, while you were getting an incredible MBA experience, you were there during the time where the Duke Blue Devils, the men's basketball team, Division I college basketball team, competed in the Atlantic Coast Conference. I got this straight from Wikipedia, by the way. Led by All-American Christian, I don't want to jumble it, Leitner.
Leitner actually graduated the spring before I got there.
Okay. And Grant Hill.
Grant Hill Duke, was on the team.
Yes. And Duke won its second national championship in as many years to become the first repeating team since UCLA's 7-year dynasty. The feat would not be accomplished again in college basketball until the Florida Gators did it in 07. So when I came to see you, you like lit up and you said, oh, I vividly remember the fall 1992 Duke versus Michigan game. I mean, like play by play,
yeah.
Right?
So they won the championship before I got there, mm-hmm. in 92. That was their second championship. Leitner was on
92.
That team.
Uh-huh.
And then I went to school starting in the fall of 92. The first big game of the year after, you know, you play a couple of lesser opponents in the early schedule. But the first big game was Duke versus Michigan. It was a Saturday night. It was a repeat matchup with the championship game from the prior year where Duke had beat the Fab Five, mm-hmm. Michigan team. And the place was just electric.
And you were not a freshman, but you were just starting your MBA.
The things you remember are things where you've got a real emotion about it, where there was something that really sort of moved the molecules for you. And for me, that's, you know, always been sports and music. And going to that game, it was, I could talk for an hour about just everything that happened over the course of that game, which Duke won.
Okay, I have to ask you, during this time when you were getting your MBA, was that when you pierced your left ear twice?
No, it was before that. That was when I was living in Toronto.
And was it during your...
I worked for 4 years between undergraduate and getting my MBA in Toronto, and that was when I got the ear pierced.
So after Duke, like you told me, I'm an airline guy. So you were recruited to American Airlines in 1994. It was on-campus recruiting. So tell me about why you chose American Airlines as opposed to a competitor at that time.
I didn't know what industry I was interested in getting into. So I was interviewing with a lot of different companies when they would come to campus. And American Airlines had an approach around what they were looking for in, you know, college graduates to come work for them. They really were looking for how you solve problems and are you analytical. They wanted to understand in the interview process how your brain worked. They didn't care if you knew a lot about the airline industry and their viewpoint. And I've taken this with me through my career at Hawaiian is, look, we've got a lot of people in our company who know about the airline industry. We can teach you the airline industry. What we need to know that we can't teach you if it's not already there is, are you curious? Do you have an analytical problem-solving approach? How do you interact with people in different situations? And so those are the things they look for. And I really enjoyed the interview process. I thought, you know, these are a bunch of, you know, really smart, energetic, driven people, and I'd love it if I had the opportunity to go to work at that place. And they gave me the offer, and that's it. I became an airline guy.
I love that story because a few things to extrapolate. So in this very difficult hiring landscape, right, for those persons who are frontline recruiters, they need to remember that every single, you know, tangible, intangible behavior, words, they are an extension of the culture of the company, right? And so that candidate is reading that. What I also love, I mean, frankly, because I also ascribe to that philosophy, is that you can teach somebody almost anything. Like I joke around and yeah. I say, well, brain surgery, maybe not, right? Or heart surgery. But a widget is a widget is a widget is a widget. I'm not disrespecting any deep knowledge, but there's something to be said. My opinion, as we also go forward in, you know, workforce development, you know, is what you said. Are you a critical thinker? Are you curious? Do you know how to speak up in the right way, right? As yeah. opposed to you have incredible deep knowledge, but you literally need to be told turn left and pull the knob.
Yeah, and those are the skills, frankly, that carry you through the rest
no
of
matter
your
what.
Career.
Right,
yeah.
Especially when you become a parent.
Well, I think about it all the time as a parent now. I'm really proud when I hear that, you know, my kids, as they were going through school or now they're starting in the workforce, that they're comfortable being the ones leading the presentation. They're comfortable talking with people senior to them in the organization, even early in the mm-hmm. in their career. Mm-hmm. That's something I look for in our team is, you know, when we're having a meeting, if someone more junior is in the meeting and they've got a good idea, it's not helpful to us if they don't speak up and share it with us. But it does take a little bit of
right
comfort to be able to do that. It takes a little
confidence.
Well,
there has to be psychological safety. They have to know that if they do speak up and it's a dissenting opinion, that they're not going to get somehow secretly retaliated against, right?
There's a tradition of Japanese management. One of the things I learned in business school a long time ago, that when people were making decisions, it was the custom for the CEO to be the one who speaks last.
Oh,
and you start
I love that.
With the most junior person in the room.
Right.
So the junior person is not intimidated. That,
right.
You know, and I see it today. You know, if I blurt out what
right.
I think the direction is going to be, and I say that emphatically at a meeting,
it's just human nature.
A lot of people will not speak up. So,
right. So if you come in and you say, it's donuts, we're going with donuts, right? Then you've got, you know, Susie Q Sato there going, oh, it really needs to be turtles, but I'm not going to say anything.
And I will admit it, sometimes I get,
well, you're not perfect.
I get excited and I go do it anyway.
But at least you're thinking about it, and therefore you are encouraging your other leadership at every level to think that way as well. Yeah, I really love
it's
that.
It's another thing I really like. I want to hear debate. I want to hear differences of opinion.
This is, you know, philosophically, it's the whole point, other than also telling stories of people like yourself. That is one of my goals with the Hawaii Business Podcast, is to encourage more respectful debate. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you for that segment of our conversation. Okay. So you spent 11 years at American Airlines. You know, you have a pattern. You kind of do well. So you move up pretty fast. And after 5 years, you became controller of the domestic airport division. You know, it was like 90 airports across the U.S. And then about 3 years after that, you became the CFO for American Eagle, which was a regional subsidiary. So was it right after that period that you got a call about some other opportunities that led you to come to Hawaiian?
Yeah, it was. And it was really, I'm really lucky to have taken that job at American Eagle, because it was at a point in my career where people at a similar level at American Airlines, often they had jobs that were really focused on a specific area. You know, someone might be the managing director of treasury, and you become one of the world's leading experts in doing aircraft financing. Mm-hmm. But that's all you're doing is aircraft financing all day long. And being the CFO at American Eagle was a much broader experience. So I was touching on labor relations and budgeting and revenue generation and negotiating purchase agreements and contracts. And that breadth actually helped my resume, frankly. And
right.
When Hawaiian was looking for a chief financial officer, as it just had emerged from bankruptcy in 2005, that's when the phone rang. And it was at a time when it was a difficult time in the airline business post 9/11. There was an economic slowdown in the early 2000s. And so things weren't moving as fast at American Airlines. And I was a little more receptive at that moment in my career when the call came. And Hawaiian sounded like a really interesting opportunity to do a job similar to the one I had, but at a company that was a public company and independent. And I ended up taking the job, and here I am 17 plus years later.
Well, let's take a short break and hear from our presenting sponsor, Servco Pacific. And when we get back, I'd like to talk more story about why you chose Hawaiian, your journey there since, because it's been 17 years. You're absolutely right. It'd be an understatement to say a lot has happened under your tenure in many positions, not the least of which was a pandemic recently. And I'd love to hear from you more about what's in store, because there's some really exciting things that we can look forward to from Hawaiian Airlines. So let's take a short break and hear from Servco Pacific. Today's episode is presented by Servco Pacific. At Servco, service to their customers and community is at the heart of what they do. And it all starts with taking care of their team members first. It's one of the reasons why they've been recognized as one of Hawaii's best places to work for over 19 years. From competitive compensation packages to investing in professional growth, Servco is dedicated to helping you create life moments that matter to you. As Servco looks to the next 100 years, they are evolving to provide more solutions to serve the mobility needs of their customers and community, and invite you to join them as their journey of innovation continues. To learn more and join one of Hawaii's best places to work, visit servco.com/careers. Welcome back, everybody. Today, we have with me Peter Ingram, President and CEO of Hawaiian Airlines and the parent company, Hawaiian Holdings, Inc. Back from the break. How was the break for you?
Break was good.
It was incredible, wasn't it? Yes.
Got some water. Feeling good.
Okay. Home stretch. So before the break, we talked about, you know, you had this opportunity. It seemed very serendipitous because you had that more generalist opportunity at your prior obligation. So you came to Hawaiian. It was founded in 1929. So, you know, it's been 94 years. It has 7,000 plus employees. You joined as CFO in November 2005. And just coincidentally, you also became an American citizen, a U.S. citizen that year, just by coincidence,
yep.
Right? And in 2011, you were promoted to President and Chief Commercial Officer. And then in 2018, you were further elevated to the current role of president and CEO. During your tenure, now, of course, you're going to say, I didn't do it alone, right? You did it with a lot of people along your side. But during your tenure, there has been incredible, strong financial stewardship to become one of the most successful U.S. carriers financially. You're leading the industry in on-time performance and customer service. You've expanded your fleet of aircraft. You expanded your route network, notably, my opinion, Osaka, Seoul, and New Zealand. And also, I'm jazzed about, you modernized the digital infrastructure. So those are the highlights. Tell me about, though, the journey, the challenges, which I have a sense you love challenges, but that's an encapsulation of all these years that you've been there, 17. But what's it like? What's it been like for you?
Yeah, well, first of all, you're right. Nobody did that by themselves, and we've had a great team to accomplish all the things that Hawaiian's been through over the last 17 years and really the last 93 years. The company I joined had a great rich history. As you said, starting in 1929, pioneering air transportation here in Hawaii, really at the infancy of the industry. We're mm-hmm. one of the oldest airlines in the world. But it's had some ups and downs over the years. And
wait, isn't 1929 the year the stock market crash?
It was.
Jeez. Okay.
Yeah. But, you know, Hawaiian's had its ups and downs. The company's been in mm-hmm. bankruptcy twice. As mm-hmm. I said, when I joined, it was right after the second bankruptcy. So the company had emerged from bankruptcy in June. I joined the company in November. It was a real diamond in the rough is the way that I look back at it now in retrospect. And I don't know that I fully appreciated that at the time. We had 25 airplanes. All of them were leased, so we didn't really own much of anything.
Mm.
Hawaiian had a strong position on the neighbor island routes, but was still building its brand as a long-haul carrier. Hadn't really established a strong brand in North America, although that work was underway. And bit by bit, brick by brick, with a lot of people coming in the company and helping, we've built a stronger network. We've built a really strong brand, deliver great hospitality to people. We've grown from, I think we had about 3,300 people when I joined, to over 7,000 today. We have 60 airplanes now, 61 to be precise,
mm-hmm.
and been able to really grow things, modernize the business, and there's still more work to do. One of the things you realize, especially when you're in the CEO job, is there's always things you can be doing to evolve the business, make it better. The needs of our guests change all the time, and we have to be observing what those changes are and how do we address them. And one thing I'm really proud of with Hawaiian is people in Hawaii think of us as a big business, and we are clearly one of the biggest, if not the biggest, company in the state. We're one of the biggest private employers.
Mm-hmm.
We differ from a lot of other businesses in Hawaii. We compete against global businesses, not just competing for business here locally in Hawaii. Most of our revenue actually comes from outside of Hawaii.
Right.
And our competitors are much bigger than us, have more resources. And we've been able to chart a path where we can succeed as a smaller carrier, which is the way we think of ourselves, is as a small business, because that's what we are in our industry. By doing things a little bit different, reflecting a different brand, a different style, giving our guests a choice that's different from American, Delta, United, Qantas, all the global airlines that we compete with every day.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about some of that. It is on purpose that I am not going to ask you about how COVID affected Hawaiian Airlines. It's not because I want to gloss over the facts or because I want to be Pollyanna, but it's the past. And what I'd like to ask you to talk about is the current and the future. Because I think my opinion is that that's where I want to focus. Because obviously, you were hit very, very hard during COVID. So
it was a difficult time.
It was a slightly difficult time. So let's just move on. So on your website, you have 5 themes that are key to this year and beyond. And let's talk about a few of those, right? So first and foremost, you told me we have to win the competitive battle here in Hawaii. We have to be the neighbor island travel champion. So talk to me about that.
Yeah, I mean, we've been the leading neighbor island carrier since our inception in 1929. And it is, and we've had various competitors over the years. We've had different people try and break into
the
business.
Yep.
We still do today, obviously. Mm-hmm. But it's important, not just because it is where the airline began and not just because air transportation is so important to Hawaii because of the nature of being an archipelago of islands in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. It is vitally important. We recognize that, obviously. But it's core to support the rest of our network as well. The ability to offer the volume of flights and the size of aircraft we operate on our North America routes and our Asia routes and our Australia routes is predicated on having the ability to connect people across the islands here. Because unlike our competitors, we don't have feed into all those routes at the points internationally. We don't have a hub in Los Angeles. We don't have a hub in
Sydney. You're not Delta in Atlanta, Georgia, right? Yeah.
So it really is key to our network is to have a successful, healthy neighbor island business. We are very aware that we've got a competitor who has come in here with very deep pockets and offering low prices and trying to knock us out of the position we've held for the last 93 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I think sometimes our competitors really underestimate us. They think a little carrier from Hawaii isn't going to be able to compete with big global carriers, and we're going to prove them wrong again because we have fantastic employees and they do a great job, and we've got to do it by running a great operation, being competitive on pricing, making sure we deliver authentic Hawaiian hospitality, which is really what separates us from other carriers, and making sure that our community understands that having a healthy, vibrant airline here in Hawaii is a really unique asset, including the 7,000 jobs it provides and some 45,000 other jobs that are indirectly supported by our business. It's really important for us to win this battle, and I need to make sure that our team is very focused on it.
You know, I can attest to the hospitality, Delta. Recently, my friend and I, we were returning from LAX, and it was right before I saw you. And your team not only had light conversation with us, not too much. I say light on purpose because I don't want to talk to people, right, that are strangers. But not just to us, but all along the way, and it wasn't like canned. It was very like, you know, contextual and dynamic. And there is something there that your team members do. It's not too much. It's not too little. And it's almost akin to, you know how we talk about, well, oh my goodness, when you travel internationally, they just treat you so well. And frankly, some of the larger domestic carriers, their team members, my opinion, they're quite rude. They treat us like cargo, like get into your seat, shut up, put your seatbelt on, right? And don't ask for anything. I'll give you water when I want to give it to you. But your team members, there is something there. So the training is working and the culture is working.
I think having the name Hawaiian on the side of the airplane really means something to our employees. You know, 90% of our employees live here in Hawaii. So despite our global operations, we're very much a Hawaii company. And there's a lot of pride that goes with that. And I think when people are representing Hawaiian Airlines, they know they're also representing Hawaii, their home. And Hawaii has a culture of hospitality and respect and pride. And that gets, you know, reflected in our culture as a business. The culture of Hawaiian Airlines, the company, and Hawaii is different, but they're very interrelated. And I'm glad you see the difference. I see it too. We're certainly not perfect.
No one's perfect.
No one is perfect.
Mm-hmm.
But I think our employees are better than others at delivering great, consistent hospitality and service. And it really is one of the things that distinguishes us and allows us as that smaller carrier to be able to be competitive against these big global behemoths.
Yeah. No, thank you for explaining that. So the next theme, which, oh my gosh, it's so exciting. So you were sharing with me that there are several large initiatives all coming to fruition this year, and that was pure coincidence. It wasn't like, hey, let's make 2023 a, you know, banging year. It was coincidence, and there's a lot to cover here. So one is, did you know that I order so much from Amazon that the delivery person, whether it's the postal worker, like struck up a conversation with my husband. Oh, yeah, your wife, lots of boxes.
Lots of boxes end up on my front door as well.
Okay, so it's not just me. So you'll be flying freight for Amazon starting up this coming fall. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, let me talk about the delivering on our commitments theme more generally first. And I know we're not going to go back and talk a lot about the pandemic.
Wait, but Peter, this is your episode. You do what you want.
Got it. You may regret that later on, but okay. Got it. One of the things, as we stabilize the business, we realize there is going to be a future. And we've got to keep investing for the future, and we've got to keep making changes in the business so that we're positioned to be even a better airline tomorrow than we are today. And a number of those investments and initiatives that we've started are coming to the point of being delivered this year.
Mm-hmm.
One you mentioned is our partnership with Amazon. Amazon faced a decision not unlike we did a number of years ago when we were operating 767 aircraft. And at some point, you start to realize that this aircraft's not in production anymore. We've got to think about transitioning to a new fleet. And they decided, similar to the decision we made in 2010, to transition to the Airbus A330 family of aircraft. And when they made that transition, they came to us and wondered if we'd be interested in being one of the contracting carriers that does the flying for them, since they don't operate the airline business themselves. And we went through that negotiation. We finally reached terms the early part of this year, and we're now deep in the preparations of getting ready to launch that new business with what will start off being 10 A330 freighter aircraft. We're going to fly Amazon packages between airports near their distribution centers. And if you want to know where their distribution centers are, I can tell you about 90% of the population of the United States lives within 100 miles of an Amazon distribution center.
We're getting one, too.
We are getting one.
Right,
yeah, they're building a facility on
right.
On Sand Island, and which will help with the two-day guarantee, which is one of the things that's challenging for them here in Hawaii because
right.
of the distance.
Well, okay, so you've just convinced me to keep my Prime membership, so they should give you a cut. So what I'm hearing is, phenotypically for our audience, they are going to experience better delivery time. Also, stop me if I'm wrong, this partnership is going to have a huge impact on Asia's ability, right, to shop on Amazon, because we are Asia light, right? We're the in-between. I mean, this is just huge and exciting.
So the flying we're going to do for them is all domestically.
Oh, okay, only domestic
the
for now.
States. At this point,
for
that
now.
could change
but you're,
over
you're
time.
But you're in, right.
But we will be, you know, flying, a lot of this flying will be on the U.S. mainland. Some of it will be between the mainland and Hawaii.
If I don't get the stuff that I want but don't need, I'm going to email you from now on.
Okay, you can just contact Amazon with that instead of contacting us. But
thank you for that partnership. That's super exciting. Okay, so the next thing that's coming to fruition is it's called Starlink. So free, fast, and frictionless Wi-Fi. I love that you folks said frictionless because right, because to make things easy and seamless and painless for people, there has to be no friction. Free, fast, frictionless Wi-Fi on board our Trans-Pacific fleet. So they have to be a certain duration, right? I'm happy about this, but then I have to tell you, I was like, oh, there goes our ability not to have to work on the plane.
So I assume that most of the people that are listening to this have been on a Hawaiian Airlines airplane. And one of the things they probably know is that this is an area where we have intentionally lagged the industry in delivering connectivity. And we live in a world now where people expect to be connected 100% of the time, even if it's kind of nice to get away from work sometimes. People like to be able to be online, whether it's to do their work emails or
play a game,
get on Facebook.
Right.
People want to be online all the time, especially if you've got 5 hours when you're sitting down and looking for something to pass the time. And the reason we've been a laggard in delivering this is because if you think about the initial generation of in-flight connectivity, it wasn't satellite-based, it was ground-based. And of course, almost all the time our planes are in the air is over the Pacific Ocean, and there's no ground stations that are going to beam up. So it was pretty easy to skip that one, and no one else had coverage over the Pacific. The second generation was what is called geosynchronous satellites. So they're satellites way, way far away from Earth that point a beam down on a certain geographic area. And initially, those didn't work so well over the Pacific either, because when they're thinking about what geographic area to point it down on, they want to point it down on area where there's a lot of people, and that's generally over land. So they started by covering over land, and over time they started to cover the oceans, first the Atlantic because it's smaller and because there's more air traffic, and then ultimately it's got to the Pacific. And that was when we thought, okay, well, we've got to start looking at this. But as we looked at it, we realized, you know, most of the coverage over the Pacific is really kind of crappy. And we don't want to add a feature to our product that we think is crappy.
Mm-hmm.
So we were slow, again, to adopt intentionally. As the service started getting better, we said, okay, we've got to start thinking about this very seriously, because this is becoming a table stakes expectation of people.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a surprise and delight anymore.
It was like, where are they?
No, I'm on the airplane and I expect to have Wi-Fi connectivity. And we were looking at this before the pandemic, and there were a couple of the geosynchronous satellite providers that had gotten to a point where the Pacific coverage was not crappy anymore. It was decent. But we were intrigued by this company Starlink, which is a subsidiary of SpaceX, which is Elon Musk's mm-hmm. satellite company. And their technology is a little bit different. It's a brand new generation, and it's called low Earth orbit satellites. And what these do is, rather than pointing a beam over a specific geographic area, they're orbiting the Earth all the time. And they operate in low Earth orbit, so they're a little closer than that prior generation. So
I'm getting a visual.
Because they're rotating all the time, the coverage over the ocean is as ubiquitous as the coverage over land.
Right.
Because they're closer, you can get higher connectivity speeds, you can get more bandwidth. And so we're going to go from having, since we've made the decision to go with the Starlink product, we're going to go from having no service to having the absolute best service. And because we've got that bandwidth and high speed, we don't have to charge a high price for it to try and dissuade some people from using it so it doesn't get overcrowded.
Right.
So
you just offer it.
We're going to offer it for free. So everyone can use it for free.
Wait, am I dumb? Is this like available now?
It's not available yet.
Okay. Thank goodness.
We're in the process of sort of working through.
About when could we expect this?
The plan is to try and get the installations done over the course of this year. And hopefully as we enter 2024, we'll have all our long haul aircraft will be equipped.
My friends and I, we are planning, the same people I was returning from LA area. We're planning, we already set a date or a month, March 2024, we're going to Vancouver. We're going to Seattle, then driving to Vancouver. So I look forward to Wi-Fi.
Hopefully we'll have it.
So unfortunately, I won't be able to not work during those two flights. Okay. So the next one is, I kidded, Amazon, obviously, you know, I love that and you folks' partnership. But actually, this one got me really excited. And I think it's because of, strongly believe in the customer experience. And also 2 months ago, there was a lot of mishaps in the industry with certain airlines and due to their lack of investing in technology and infrastructure. So when I read about your Amadeus, well, first of all, that's just a fun name for that company, Amadeus Passenger Service System, I got really excited. So tell me about that.
Yeah, this is a system. So if you think about, you know, you want to know what a passenger servicing system is, you can think about every time you interact with Hawaiian Airlines, there is a number of transactions. Every time you take a flight, it's going to be multiple transactions. First, you've got to go to our website and search for the flight. Then when you pick the flight, you purchase a ticket. Maybe you decide you want to enjoy an extra special experience, an upgrade to a first class seat or an extra comfort ticket. Maybe your plans change and you have to change your reservation at some point. You get to the airport, you have to check in. If you're traveling with a bag, you've got to check a bag. All of those transactions need to be recorded somewhere. And ultimately, the place where we record them is in our passenger servicing system. And the one we've had for a number of years was made by a competitor of Amadeus. It was actually a company called Sabre that used to be a subsidiary of American Airlines. It was their internal reservation system originally. And Sabre had fantastic technology in the period where technology was based on mainframe computers and green screen interfaces, and it was so good and so reliable, and you know, 24-hour uptime. It's really been a great system, but the world has moved on. We don't use mainframe computers anymore. We have cloud computing. We have web-based applications, and over time, that technology has limited our ability to innovate and evolve other technological aspects of our business. And so we've looked at this a couple of times, and last year we decided to make the transition to the Amadeus system, which is the biggest global competitor for Sabre. And we really think they've done a much better job over the last 10 or 12 years of evolving their legacy system, adapting to new technologies, making it more intuitive. And so we signed a contract. We're getting ready to do that transition. It's the transition. The cutover is actually going to happen this spring. It's an enormous project.
Oh, because I can only imagine.
In addition to sort of putting in this new system, there's 40 or 50 different systems that we have that have to interface with that PSS. So if you think about our kiosks at the airport, our web applications, our mobile app, all of our check-in systems, you've got to make sure all the barcode scanning devices are adaptable to the new system. It's got to tie into our revenue accounting system so that we can process the revenue. So dozens of different systems all have to be adapted to interface with this. And then every ticket we've sold over the last 330 days before we cut over, we've got to take all of that information out of the old system and upload it into the new system and make sure that when people go to check in or to change their reservation, that you've got everything there in a format that it works seamlessly. So our guests never understand that this was going on behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
So hundreds of people throughout the company have been.
No, it's absolutely a huge project.
This.
Even when it's a simple, even it's when it's a singular tech implementation, it can be a doozy. So, but this is going to be really exciting. You know, as you mentioned, it's going to touch all aspects of the customer experience. And just to help our listeners get a visual, you know, the next time, let's say something does happen at a gate, right? It's even going to, and there's a long line forming at the desk, right? With all these issues and they want to be serviced. Now your airport staff are going to also benefit and therefore the customers to experience simplified complex tasks so they can really focus on more care and service to the customers.
Yeah, it's going to give them a more intuitive system so they can work more efficiently, give service quicker and more accurately. But even beyond that, I hope when we do the transition, nobody even notices that
I'm not going to ask you when it is then. I'm not going to ask you.
Where guests should really see the benefit, and this will occur over time, but one of the things this is going to enable us to do is to be more innovative and be more more quick about our ability to adapt changes. So when people say to us, why doesn't your website do this? Or I wish your website could do that. A lot of times we've already said, yeah, we wish it could do that too. But, you know, that's really ends up being kind of complicated.
Sometimes the guy on the hammock is too long. Yes.
So what this will allow us to do is to innovate a little more quickly, be a little bit more flexible in how we adapt. And hopefully, you know, really the word I use, it'll make us more nimble as we adapt to the changing needs and wants of our guests going forward.
That's really neat. And the final thing I want to talk about from your key themes, because there's a lot more, and I encourage everyone to go on your website and they can see all five and all the details. And also, you folks have a blog going. There's major transparency going on. But the next one I'd like to ask you to talk a little bit about is your efforts to be net zero by 2050, which I have to tell you sounds impossible. So tell me the plans, the roadmap, and the strategy set in motion, and what you've already done, and what's the near future to be done towards this net zero by 2050?
Yeah, I think this is really important for us. It's really important for our entire industry. And, you know, having been in the airline business now for almost 30 years, and you know I'm passionate about being an airline
guy. You're an airline guy.
We already touched on that. But I'm also very proud of the service that we deliver. And if you think about even before my time in the airline business, you know, 1978 was when the U.S. airline industry was deregulated. Before that, people flew in the U.S., but it was expensive in real terms. And it was really only the domain of the wealthy that had the ability to fly. It wasn't, not everyone in the country was familiar with getting on an airplane and moving around. And that's changed. And air travel is very much a part of our lives. It's part of my kids' lives. And it's a great thing because that travel allows us, when we have family members who are living somewhere distant, we're a lot closer when you can get on a flight and go and visit. And you can stay connected with those family members who don't live in the same city.
I love that you said this, by the way, because actually, I'm surprised I don't have it written down. When I was prepping last night, I said, he keeps saying, it's cute. He keeps saying, I'm an airline guy. But then my brain said, he's an airline guy, but he's really about connections and about building community. Because that is what airline travel, in my humble opinion, does. So please continue.
Our purpose at Hawaiian Airlines is to connect people.
Well, okay,
with
well, there you go.
There you go.
Okay.
But bringing people to different experiences, making connections with their family and friends, bringing cultures together. Airlines do that better than anyone else. And it's a great thing. In delivering that great thing, there are some negative consequences.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
One of the negative consequences is we put a lot of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Now, relative to electricity generation or ground transportation, it's actually a small percentage. We're about 2-3% of global airline emissions or global carbon dioxide emissions. But our percentage is liable to grow over the next several years because we're going to be one of the hardest sectors to decarbonize over time because the technology's not there. We could go down on the street right now and we could start counting how many electric cars are going by. They're out there today. You go over to the airport, you're not going to find electric airplanes flying around. The technology doesn't exist. And for getting to San Francisco or getting to Tokyo, battery technology is probably never going to advance to the point where we can store enough energy for a long haul.
So what is it then?
The biggest thing we can do in the near term is something called sustainable aviation fuel. And sustainable aviation fuel is chemically identical to the fossil fuel-based jet fuel we use on our airplanes today. In fact, you can store it in the same tanks, you can deliver it through the same pipelines on the same ships, but it comes from organic sources, not fossil fuel-based. And so the carbon emissions that come with that are dramatically lower. And one of the things we're focused on is how can we begin adopting this and then grow our adoption of sustainable aviation fuel over time to reduce our carbon footprint. And then what technologies can we identify over the decades ahead to get us to that net zero goal by 2050?
Well, I know you signed the pledge on the Hawaii Executive Collaborative, right?
Yeah.
You're one of the first organizations to sign that pledge. So I know you're very, very serious. So I wasn't challenging you. I was just being very honest that net zero by 2050 for your industry seems pretty daunting, but you're serious about it. Okay, so here we are at the end, Airline Guy. Peter, thank you so much for spending time with me today. Thank you very much for being, for willing to be the first guest of the season two of the Hawaii Business Podcast. It's just been an absolute delight to talk story with you and also learn about Hawaiian Airlines, your career, of course, and also what's ahead of us, all of us in the state of Hawaii.
It's been great. My pleasure. And hopefully we'll have an opportunity to sit down and talk again.
Yes. Thank you, Peter.
All right.
You've been listening to the Hawaii Business Podcast presented by Surfco Pacific. If you're a new listener, be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit us at hawaiibusiness.com. If you like this episode, leave us a rating or review. Again, I'm your host, Anyang Nakata. Mahalo for joining us today and see you next time.